Chapter 2. Monday, July 30, 2012. Space Shuttle Endeavour, Low Earth Orbit. Weightlessness embraced John Wells like an old friend. John adjusted to zero-G better than any man alive, or so his doctors told him. Nearly 50 years old, the lanky astronaut with deep-set eyes and bushy eyebrows was something of a medical phenomenon. His sinewy body showed no ill effects from his recent record-breaking 400-day stay in space. The lack of gravity brought back a flood of memories of life on the International Space Station during that long stay, of zipping between crowded cylindrical modules crammed with prepackaged meals and electronic equipment, of long work days repairing critical mission systems, of rousing talks over meals, and of 16 glorious sunrises every day. Now, on his fourth space mission, John again felt at home, and he felt that familiar twinge. The stabbing pain that he'd bottled up deep inside for many months, the realization that following his calling to space tore him away from those he loved most.
"Time to climb out of those Gumby suits,"
Colonel Melanie Knox, Endeavour's commander, said over the space shuttle's internal communication system once they reached low Earth orbit.
"You can come up to the main deck now."
"Roger that," John replied. Navy Captain Sean O'Brien, the big man seated to John's left in the shuttle's windowless lower deck, unlocked and twisted off his helmet, then signaled for his partners to do the same. Dr. Michelle Caskey, the third party in the tiny hold, shook her hair free as she removed the helmet, her auburn hair floating up in the weightless environment. Sean, Michelle, John, and, in a fashion, their spacecraft designer, Rex Edwards, were the future crew of the interplanetary spaceship Epsilon, aptly named for the fifth letter in the Greek alphabet. The space shuttle Endeavour would deliver them to Epsilon, America's fifth spacefaring ship that followed in the tradition of Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and the space shuttle. 5 decades of manned space experience, and John and his two crewmates would need to rely on everything the space program had learned in that time in order to survive the most difficult manned space mission of all time, a manned mission to Mars. The three astronauts shed their orange space suits in favor of pocket-rich cargo pants and matching polo shirts. Michelle buckled her trademark pink fanny pack around the base of her shirt and helped the others store their gear in the shuttle's lower deck. Ready for action, the red-shirted trio floated through the access hatch to the crowded upper deck and cockpit area. John was first, and he looked out the small overhead observation window, amazed anew at the breathtaking blues, whites, greens, and browns of the planet rotating below him.
"Bring back a few memories, Hawk?" Sean asked as he floated up from behind.
John's nickname, Hawk, came from his days as a sharp-eyed Navy pilot, finding submarines the old-fashioned way, visually. Sean's call sign was Bear, and the handle fit him. Brown and gray hair covered the thick arms and neck of this big man. Shocks of brown sprang up like a hairy ascot from the front of Sean's polo shirt.
"Seems like just yesterday I was coming home," John replied.
"It was just yesterday," Michelle chimed in. "You've only had 7 months to recuperate between the two longest space missions in U.S. history."
As the Earth rolled by, John nodded in silence, thinking back on those short 7 months since his space station mission. They'd been difficult months as he, Amy, and his 4 children struggled with the decision to say yes to John's life dream, to visit another planet. Then came the frenetic training, the separation, the stress, and finally, 2 weeks ago, a mysterious alien confrontation on Mars. Until a moment ago, it had all been a blur.
"Hey, Earth to John,"
Michelle teased as she tugged on his shirt. The secret dread John tried to rationalize away had finally broken loose from the little cage where he kept it hidden.
He thought of Amy and four growing children who needed a husband and father more than they needed the fame of his space exploits. Ahead of him were nearly 500 days in zero-G, including a lonely month in orbit while Sean and Michelle explored Mars, and nearly 1 billion kilometers of space travel. 1 billion kilometers that stood between John and home. His family had endured the impact of what he'd always felt was a calling, an unshakable lifelong tug at his spirit, to space exploration. Yet for the first time in a frantic 7 months of post-flight celebration and pre-flight preparation, John was forced in this quiet moment to confront the brutal reality that had long ago consumed his wife and kids. For the next 16 months, Amy and the children were on their own. Floating above his friends as they watched their home planet in silence, John again committed Amy and the children to God's care. He believed with all his heart what he'd promised Amy just days ago. God will provide. And yet, the dread continued to tug at him. This mission would put them and his faith in God's provision to the acid test. Robert Kanuski is dead, NASA's Mars mission flight director said. Their ground-based leader of the mission, Dan Jefferson, spoke to the crew via radio only 2 hours after their launch from Kennedy Space Center. His sister, nephew, and 12 others are in quarantine. We now have our hands on one of those glowing alien spheres, a duplicate of what the spiders handed to our rover on Mars. It's crazy down here. Hundreds of people, including your families, saw the aliens lift off from the swamp. Robert confronted the spiders face to face. Pretty convincing evidence that we're not alone. But how? John asked, floating with the rest of the crew in the upper deck area, a microphone suspended midair before them. He groaned inside at the pain Amy was surely experiencing in the media frenzy at the launch site, and perhaps at home. She deserved better. Heart attack got him, the flight director continued. Robert had a history of cardiac problems. He was resuscitated once by paramedics, spoke a few words to his sister, then died on the way to the hospital. We're all in a state of shock. Everybody knew Dr. Mars. According to his sister, her 9-year-old son found the things in the swamp behind the VIP stands. Robert sent the boy back to land, but stayed in the swamp with the spiders, or aliens. To hear the story, the lead spider made the same presentation we watched on Mars, a shining sphere that went from gold to blue when Robert touched it. Once he accepted the blue ball, they lifted off. The spiders flew out to sea, then, poof, they dove into the water and disappeared. Just like that. Where'd they come from? Sean asked, his head cocked to one side. Must have walked up from the ocean, Flight Director Jefferson replied. Found their tracks across the beach, past the vacant pad 39A, all the way to the VIP stands. They crossed several kilometers of sand and marsh. No telling how long ago they came up. Security's been pretty tight along the coast for the past week.
What about his sister and the boy? Michelle asked.
Devastated and in quarantine. The docs locked them both up along with everyone who touched Robert, the orb, or the boy. It's a zoo at Canaveral. All over NASA, in fact. From contamination hysteria to end-of-the-world stuff. And the media are going nuts. John heard Dan Jefferson laugh in frustration. Be glad you're in orbit, he said. We're getting mobbed down here. No one was prepared for this, least of all Dr. Kanuski. Sean spoke up after a long silence.
There's one major question that needs to be resolved, Dan. Are we still go for Mars? I mean, if the aliens are on Earth now, what about the mission? For the record, of course, I want to go.
Wondered when you'd ask, Dan said, his tone more somber. We just checked with Jet Propulsion Labs. The images continue to arrive from Mars showing the alien craft next to Viking 1. We don't know what that means now that the alien craft are on Earth, too, It's possible, even probable, that today's sighting is some sort of a sophisticated trick meant to derail the mission. Since nothing has changed on Mars, Dan said, the mission is still on.
Malcolm Raines adjusted his clerical collar as the director counted down from 10. He popped his third antacid that day in an attempt to quell the stomach distress that plagued him each time he spoke in public. Bright lights behind the cameras made his audience almost invisible, but it wasn't the visitors in the gallery that he cared about. Nearly a billion people would hear his voice tonight on cable, through the internet, and on the airwaves. This was his moment. Live from Burbank, California, this is Foster Williams with news that could change your life. And what news it is! Aliens land in Florida, humanity heads for Mars, and a leading space explorer dies of heart failure after greeting interplanetary visitors. To Malcolm's right, his plastic host soaked up the adulation of the crowd. Malcolm could see the cracks in Foster's pancake makeup, the man's fake tan in sharp contrast to his perfect bleached teeth. Malcolm smiled at the camera as Foster gestured in his direction.
You keep hitting home runs, Father Raines. You said we'd hear from the aliens, and it happened on a historic day. Every one of your prophecies has been dead on. Tell us more about the past week and what this morning's momentous visitation means.
Foster settled into the deep couch and crossed his legs. Malcolm nodded, gesturing with massive light brown hands as he spoke.
We are not alone, Foster. That much is clear. My prophecy in Phoenix last Saturday foretold today's remarkable events. I heard these words audibly. Watch for us when you venture forth. Endeavor ventured to the stars, the first step for humanity's initial foray to another planet. And, as promised, the blessed visitors have now arrived.
Sounds like those visitors stole your famous Venture Forth tagline, Reverend, Foster said.
Malcolm hated to be called Reverend. Everyone knew him as Father Raines, and Foster knew that. It had been a deliberate dig.
Those were not my words, Malcolm said, narrowing his eyes at his arrogant host. That phrase came from a revelation that God gave me more than a year ago, shortly after my first visit to your show, in fact.
Malcolm paused, a scowl creasing his face.
As I prophesied, they have come to Earth at last, and we will see them again.
Gasps arose from the theater seats beyond the blinding glare of stage lights. Malcolm knew that 100 devotees, many from his world-inclusive faith megachurch in Phoenix, Arizona, were here in hopes of some new revelation. He intended to deliver. Foster leaned forward, looking noticeably uneasy. Malcolm had left this juicy tidbit out of their pre-show coordination, on purpose.
This morning, as their craft lifted off from the Cape, 6 emissaries rising majestically into the sun, I heard them speak audibly to my spirit. It was a remarkable moment, and I am honored beyond words to be God's oracle on earth.
He paused.
Their words were clear. We go to that place where life began.
He paused a second time, flexing his fingers in trademark Malcolm Raines fashion.
I predict that Africa, the land of my forefathers, is their next destination.
Wednesday, August 1, 2012, Clear Lake City, Texas.
You already tied 'em, Mom,
Albert insisted as Amy Wells double-knotted the laces on her son's sneakers for the third time in 10 minutes. The petite brunette looked up in surprise, jarred from a daydream of John's launch and flying silver spiders.
Oh, okay. Hurry or you'll miss the bus, she said, kissing him on the cheek as she pushed him toward the door.
You okay, Mom? Her oldest son, Abe, asked, holding the door as Albert ran out.
You look kind of out of it, you know?
Amy nodded and stood to watch her youngest son race to the curb and leap onto the church bus, headed to day camp. Abe shrugged and grabbed a hockey stick from the hall closet on his way out to join his friends, who waited in the front yard. Amy stood at the screen door as he swung the stick and jousted with his buddies on their way down the street. Amy held the door open a moment longer, watching the morning come alive in their brick and stucco neighborhood of Clear Lake City, Texas. They were a stone's throw from the Johnson Space Flight Center in a modest house that had seemed large when she and John moved in 13 years ago with only one child. Cicadas chirped and buzzed all around her, filling the background with their strange song. Life, albeit without John, was getting back to normal, just a little. Down the curved street she could see her latest adversaries. 6 television vans were queued up for the next run on her house in search of the latest tidbit of news to feed a nation of news junkies. Faceless people, and, she reminded herself, probably good people, but their addiction paid a rude army of news anchors and photographers to stand for most of the day on her walk. Amy shut the front door and locked it. She pulled her long brown hair into a ponytail as she walked back to the kitchen. For a moment she fought the never-ending urge to clean something, then picked up a rag and disinfectant and began to spray her countertops. For the third time that morning. Half an hour later, Amy stood in front of the sink, her shoulders slumped. A tear ran down her cheek unchecked as she stared into the backyard, plagued by visions of spaceships breaking up in meteoric fireballs and astronauts marooned in Martian orbit. 6-year-old Alice pulled Amy out of her nightmare, tugging at her pocket.
"The toilet stopped up again, Mommy."
Amy turned and smiled through red eyes, then knelt in front of her daughter.
"Arthur used too much paper again?"
she asked as she ran her fingers through her daughter's blonde curls. Alice nodded.
"Don't cry. Daddy's coming back. He promised,"
she said cheerfully.
"He will,"
Amy said with a sniffle and a weak grin. Her daughter pulled at Amy's hand.
"Arthur needs you."
5 minutes later, wielding the well-used plunger like a mock sword, Amy shooed a red-faced Arthur off to the den to join his sister and a waiting video game. Amy went to her own room, closed the door behind her, and collapsed in the soft embrace of her bed. She pulled John's pillow to her, burying her head in the soft down as she breathed in the last of his scent, a faint whiff of Old Spice aftershave. She stroked the down pillow as if rubbing her hands through the soft bristles of John's gray flat-top haircut. She pulled it close as she prayed in whispers, crying out for solace and for strength. She pleaded with her Creator for wisdom, for understanding of aliens, prophets, and planets. She begged for endurance and for freedom from her insane focus on control. Freedom from obsessive cleaning and some semblance of peace in her daily battle to manage her diabetes, her environment, the chaos, dust, clutter, kids, schedules, and daily emergencies. She prayed for balance, for strength, and for John. Amy rose from the bed. She'd been here before many times and had learned to cope without John. It was time to move on and to trust in God's constant provision.
"Alice? Arthur?"
she called out, grabbing her baseball cap, Arthur's soccer ball, and Alice's jump rope.
"Let's go to the park."